Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jessica Hathaway, and I'm here today for Tyrone Bateman. I'm going to begin with the Batson claim, unless the court would prefer I start with the first point. So to talk about the facts just briefly, the state first struck four African-American jurors. The fourth juror was not allowed by the trial court. On that fourth juror, one of the reasons the state gave was that that juror lived in the neighborhood. And then the trial court, on its own, sua sponte, said, wait a minute, there is another African-American juror who lived in the neighborhood that you did not strike, therefore I will not allow that strike. So then the state struck the next African-American juror, who was Juror Thompson, who is the subject of this case. And for his reason, he said that Thompson beat me to the question about the degrees of murder and basically asked, are there other things that first-degree murder should consider? And then defense counsel said, that's not what he said. That's a misrepresentation of what he said. And what he had actually said was, what's the difference between first and second degree murder? And then pointed out a juror of another race, Brindle, who really had volunteered a question about punishment earlier in the case.
Didn't he also say something about a sentence being harsher?
He asked, what is the difference between first and second degree murder? And then the prosecutor answered in sort of a long answer. And then Thompson said, so is that more harsher? Is sort of his exact
words. So one's more harsher than the other?
Yes, and then the prosecutor explained some more. Basically said there's degrees of murder, there's different elements, and gave this long explanation.
The other juror that you compare him to, the white juror, the questions that that person asked indicated potentially something in favor of the state. Doesn't that eliminate any comparison? Because clearly, if it's on the peremptory challenge, the state isn't required to strike jurors who it indicates are favorable to it simply because the same topic came up.
That is something that has come up on appeal and what we've been talking a lot about since this case has been going on. In the trial court, what's important in this case to recognize is that in the trial court, there were all these issues raised about pretext. There were issues about misrepresentation. And then there was this juror also raised. And the trial court just summarily denied the claim. There were no fact findings.
But the trial court heard all these two witnesses were in fairly close contemporaneously to each other. And as I recall from the record, the white juror seemed to be concerned that they couldn't give death. So wouldn't it seem odd that a prosecutor would be required to strike somebody who wanted to punish the defendant more than what the prosecutor was seeking? That it seems to me that it's a big stretch to say that's similar to somebody who is maybe just ambivalent.
Well, to answer your question, you know, keep in mind that the test for this court it was, and for what the trial court should have done is a totality of the circumstances test.
Right.
And so it's not that the state should have struck Brindle. If you look at the totality of the circumstances surrounding the strike of Thompson, the black juror, you see a number of things. And the similarly situated juror is one of the things that sort of raises questions. But there are other factors as well. There's the fact that four out of six of the state's strikes were African Americans when there are only seven available out of the 24. There's the fact that after he was denied on his original strike four, he moved on to the next African American juror. There's the fact of the misrepresentation, which Miller L. Has said is in itself evidence of pretext because it turns the reason into an illegitimate reason, which is a reason that this court has recognized going all the way back to Parker as being one of the factors the trial court needs to consider.
So your argument would be, even if this court does not agree with your argument that there was a similarly situated white juror, there's sufficient additional evidence?
Correct. And there, part of the problem in this case is that, you know, cases have recognized for a long time that this process is very subjective. And the state is relying on that to try to say that this court needs to read this cold record and say that there was no problem with the strike. But what really happened here is the trial court didn't make the fact findings that it needed to. And so
have
really
we required that kind of finding? Or is it this? You're saying this case presents a good reason why we should?
There's no requirement for written findings of fact unless the statutes or the rules require it. Are there any that require it?
There's no requirement of written findings of fact. However, and I would say this is a little bit of an open question at this point, what the trial court's actual duty is once a Batson claim is raised. And there's lots of language and cases going back even to Batson that say the trial court has a duty to consider the totality of the relevant facts and circumstances of the case. That language is mentioned in one of the McFadden cases, I think the 2007 McFadden case. It's also mentioned in Miller L.
And looking at all the facts and circumstances, must we also consider that the eventual jury, including the alternates, did include three African Americans, and that the prosecutor didn't use all of his peremptory strikes to strike African Americans?
I don't think so, Your Honor. The state has argued that, and relying on that fact would, you know, make it so that, you know, let's look at the McFadden cases, for example. In both of those cases, the state did not use all of its strikes against African Americans. In one, it used 4 out of 9, and in one, it used 5 out of 9. I don't think this court has ever had a case where the state has used every single one of its strikes against African Americans. The question is, did it do so on this one challenge strike? So a short answer to your question is I think the fact that there were three remaining is irrelevant.
Do you agree with me that I see in the state's brief cited, but also in the Court of Appeals opinion, that to me it looks like all the law is totality of the circumstances, which means the judge considers the things that the state wants to say, considers the things that the defense wants to say. Well, one thing that's troubling to me that was in the Court of Appeals opinion is this word that a particular factor was a crucial factor. Would you agree with me that it doesn't make any sense, if we're going to consider the totality of the circumstances, to say any one factor is more crucial than the other?
I would agree with that.
Are there cases that address whether the key argument was there that 4 out of 6 strikes were of African Americans, and that your argument is that the prosecutor misrepresented the question posed by Mr. Thompson, that in fact it was in response to his talking about first and second degree murder and asking if people had any comments or questions. So assuming we were to accept that and it was a misstatement of of what the juror said, are there cases that say that's sufficient?
Whether a misstatement by itself is sufficient?
And you said you can infer pretext from that, but must you infer pretext, or is that something that's in the discretion of the trial court?
Well, Miller L. Spoke of, I believe the language from Miller L. is, the state simply mischaracterized, and that was evidence of pretext. There are Missouri cases on this question, and one of them is State versus Bass, a Western District case. That was a case where, on appeal, everyone realized that the reason that the state gave for striking a black juror was just not in the record. It was just completely attributable to some other juror. The Western District would not consider that argument on appeal, would not acknowledge it, because it hadn't been raised below. Another one is State versus Johnson. In that case, that's out of the Eastern District. In that case, it was raised below that the state was mischaracterizing. The Eastern District said that by itself we're not going to find as evidence the pretext. In that case, there were also a bunch of similarly situated jurors that were not raised in the trial court. That case, there was also a dissent by Judge Draper, who also dissented in this case. The theme of both of those dissents is that we are making this very, very difficult on appeal, and that that is contrary to what Batson was supposed to do. The theme of the dissent in Johnson was what I'm here advocating today, essentially, and that is that the law has evolved in the wrong direction, that the trial court has a duty to consider all these factors, and then if it doesn't, the appellate court can't excuse that. The appellate court has to consider everything that's apparent from the record. And that is something that courts do when there's other kinds of trial court error. And I try to make this point in my reply brief, that once with other kinds of error, once you make an objection, carry that objection forward, put it in your motion for new trial, courts on appeal will look at the record and they will consider what facts are in the record that we can rely on. And there shouldn't be a different standard for Batson claims where it's not just the defendant's rights that are at issue. It's the equal protection rights of the jurors who don't get to exercise their rights as a citizen.
If we were to infer, if your argument is that if a reason for the strike is given, which the record doesn't support, that because the juror said X and the juror didn't, the juror said Y, does there also have to be some finding that it was not an innocent error, that it was an intentional lie?
That's a difficult question because it's so hard to tell from the record. And that's why the trial court needs to make that decision. Thank you.
May it please the court, and we believe that the trial court did make that decision. Appellant has taken the trial court's finding that the reason for the strike was racially neutral and reinterpreting that to mean, well, what the trial court actually said was that all the court meant was that it was facially racially neutral. And that's not what the court said. If the court was making a determination based solely on facial race neutrality, it would have made its ruling after the state had made its explanation without waiting for the argument for pretext. But here, the parties did make their full Batson claim, went through all the stages of Batson, and the court made a determination at the end of the Batson challenge, which refers to all of the steps of the Batson challenge.
Does the evidence support that, where the reason the prosecutor gave, and I know you are here, it's accurate, but my reading of the transcript suggests the prosecutor said, now I'm going to talk to you about first and second degree murder, and if you can follow the instructions. And he asks five jurors, and this guy's the fifth one, and he says, well, I think I can, but what are first and second degree murder? There's nothing initiated there. It's trying to answer the prosecutor's question.
I think that is an interpretation. I don't think that's the only interpretation of the way it came up, because we had five jurors who said, what the prosecutor said, question was, and I would say the question was.
He didn't say it's 'cause somebody who doesn't understand criminal law. I mean, they may have known what it is. He said they initiated the questioning.
And in a sense, I believe he did initiate the questioning. And the question was about you're going to be instructed on what the law is. Can you follow the court's instruction when the court gives it to you? Other jurors are able to say to the court, without knowing the difference between first and second degree murder, without knowing
so
that the court
blindly,
was going to provide.
We basically want jurors to blindly agree without understanding the question? Or else they're,
you didn't need to understand the difference between first degree and second degree murder to answer that question. The question just said you're going to read. Well,
what I'm trying to get to is if, and I appreciate where you're coming from. Mm-hmm. Were I to find that it was not a correct characterization, or if I thought, can I infer, does the record support that the prosecutor intentionally misrepresented, and are there cases that address whether that's a basis for a Batson challenge in itself, or is more required?
The cases that opposing counsel discussed are the only cases that I'm familiar with in Missouri. They're both Court of Appeals cases, and they're both factually different in this case, in that nothing else to support an argument was pretext was ever raised. And
what
so,
about Miller Elson? You can infer pretext from the fact that you've given an invalid explanation, one that, that's not supported by the record.
And again, I'd say that, that it, under a totality of the circumstances with a pretext argument, that it can be a circumstance. As we are, you know, and as our brief makes clear, totality of circumstance doesn't mean four circumstances. These four circumstances, which the court has specifically laid out, are not the only circumstances to be discussed. Would that be a factor for the court to consider? Certainly, it can be.
If it were not an intentional misrepresentation, then how could it be relevant to pretext? If it was a mistaken misrepresentation, that wouldn't have any relevance to whether the prosecutor was making a pretextual strike.
Exactly. And it's only relevant if it's intentional, because it can only be evidence of racial motivation if it is an intentional misrepresentation.
How does our totality of the circumstances test square with the statement in Miller L. that if the stated reason does not hold up, its pretextual significance does not fade, because a trial judge or an appeals court can imagine a reason that might not have been shown up as false? In other words, you have to look at what the prosecutor said.
Right.
Neither the trial nor the appellate court can think, look at it and say, oh, well, you know, this and this and this would have justified it too. So I'm not going to find its protection.
Right, right.
You have to look at what the prosecutor
look
said.
Look only at the reason.
Totality can't. We have that, and you look at it, but you can't use that to find other reasons.
And I agree. If you don't state a if the prosecutor doesn't state a reason at the time, you can't go and imagine other reasons. And I think that's the context for that. Here, you still have to look at the reason and look at the circumstances surrounding the reason. I mean, we have the suggestion that Thompson was always one of the intended strikes, and this was always the reason the prosecutor was going to give. The record does not bear that out. Thompson was the replacement strike for the strike. For the strike that the Batson challenge was granted on. And I do find it compelling.
In looking at the totality of the circumstances, because the kind of the way that I read defense counsel's argument is that we should assume the trial court really didn't do the last step, that they just stopped after there was this alleged neutral reason. But doesn't the fact that the trial court actually struck, I mean, I think it could go either way, the fact that the trial court struck the previous black juror, because number one, it demonstrates that he did the last step because he said they met their burden. Okay. And then I understand her argument is well, that ought to be some evidence that this particular prosecutor had a pretext, at least as it relates to that juror. So if we are to look at the totality of the circumstances, doesn't that particular factor cut both ways?
I think it actually cuts stronger in favor of the trial court, because one, it does show the trial court was paying careful attention to the reasons given, was not just resting on, well, it's race neutral, so I'm going to let it go, but was actually engaging in analysis. There were two reasons given for the strike of Jallo, which was later overturned. Counsel's only focused on one, the lived in similarity. The other one was that, and if I may grab my notes real quickly, dealt with a question that they had about how do you feel about someone who has a paid lawyer versus being represented by a public defender, and the prosecutor said that this juror had responded to that question. Again, whether this was something in his memory that he just misremembered, or whether it was actually false, we don't know. But the court noted about that, said, well, it looked like her hand was originally up, but then she put it down, and thus it's not clear if she had an issue with that or not. Not only do we see the court actually paying attention and addressing the reasons given for pretext, but also noting that something seemed to not properly state what had occurred during the voir dire. And then going back just to your question about, well, when we read the record, I'm not necessarily convinced that this was misrepresentation. We believe the issue of whether it's a misrepresentation or not, it was an issue for the trial court, who was in the better position to understand the manner and the way the questioning went, was better able to observe the demeanor of the parties that was going, and would have understand tone and inflection and things like that, and would have been able to tell if the prosecutor's explanation was just seemingly made up, or was at least a reasonable interpretation of what happened. We believe that there's a sufficient record here to say that it was a reasonable interpretation, one that the juror was showing some initiative in bringing up this question about what the difference was when that wasn't what was specifically asked of him, and then continuing to ask questions about it even after the prosecutor said, well, I understand you have questions about that. The judge is going to give you the instructions and tell you what the difference is between the two crimes, because that's the role of the court. The role of the court is to instruct the jury as to the elements, not the role of the lawyers. Yet that wasn't a sufficient question, sufficient answer for the jury. The juror kept asking questions, and in fact said, well, is that like a harsher punishment? It was Mr. Thompson that then first broached the issue of, well, do these different degrees affect the punishment that one can fit for the crime? And it's not just that he showed some initiative, but he specifically, the prosecutor remembered that he showed some initiative about sentencing, about that suggested leniency. And in light of the circumstances that there is a reasonable interpretation from the record, in light of the circumstance that this was a backup strike, this wasn't a first intentionally planned strike, and thus you would not expect the prosecutor's explanation to be as articulate, as maybe well-spoken, as you would in other circumstances, there definitely isn't any suggestion here that this was an intentional misrepresentation. Those cases that we were talking about, in those cases, and Johnson really just refers back to Bass. Bass never actually got into the third step analysis because they didn't make any pretext strike. They just said, well, just getting the reason wrong is enough to grant relief on the Batson challenge. Actually, at the trial court level, there was no pretext argument made because even the defense counsel at trial had misrepresented. So Bass doesn't necessarily inform us fully on that issue, but certainly there has to be, I would assume, if you're trying, the purpose of a Batson challenge is for the defendant. The burden never shifts from the defendant to prove intentional racial discrimination. If the prosecutor is not intentionally misstating the record, and we believe because the record at least supports the inferences that the prosecutor drew here, that he wasn't misstating the record, especially in light of the fact that this is an extra strike that he's trying, that he has to kind of come up with on the fly, that there isn't a showing of intentional racial discrimination, of intentional misrepresentation to reach that. So even if you believe it's a misrepresentation, to then say, well, then we're required to find ill motive, even if there's no evidence of ill motive, strikes me as illogical. There's been arguments made about that somehow that there shouldn't be a deference given to the trial court because of some alleged misunderstanding of Batson. We as we've argued in our brief, we don't think that was a misunderstanding of Batson. As the court has already asked questions, for totality of circumstances should mean totality of the circumstances, not limited to those four. This court has never limited those four. One that has been discussed this morning was the striking of not using all strikes against African American jurors, even though there were strikes available. This court recently said in State versus Johnny Johnson that was a relevant factor.
It's relevant, but you don't get immunity once
no.
you.
You certainly not. It's one of the factors to consider. When you look at the other pretext factors in this case, we believe they also support the granting of or the denial of the Batson and the upholding of the challenge. One, accepting, and again, I think that the trial court is at least entitled to deference here as to whether or not it was an actual misrepresentation or a reasonable interpretation of the record. But accepting that, and if you accepted it, that was a reasonable interpretation for the trial court to reach, was there evidence of pretext shown? looking at the traditional factors, in addition to the factor regarding not striking all of the African-American jurors, this was a high level of relevance to the case. Not only in any criminal case would someone who's more inclined to harsh punishment be a better juror for the state than someone inclined to lesser punishment, but that was the only issue to be litigated, is whether the defendant was guilty of first-degree murder or a lesser degree of murder. So a juror's tendency, proclivity, possibility that they might be lenient is exceptionally relevant in this case. And further, as this court's questions have already suggested, Juror Brindle and Juror Thompson were not similarly situated. They were similar in form, in that they both asked questions, not in direct response to a question. And even if we don't think Thompson was necessarily coming out of nowhere with his question out of some innate desire to be lenient, it at least was an unresponsive question. It wasn't directly responsive to the question that was asked by the prosecutor. If his question suggests leniency and the other's question suggests a harsher punishment, and I don't think there's any real argument that Mr. Brindle's question suggested that he would like to give as harsh a punishment as possible, they might be similar in form, but they're not similar in substance. It's the substance that makes a juror fit or not fit, or desirable or not desirable for jury service. And I think that, you know, you look to the McFadden cases, this court doesn't want to tolerate superficial reasons for upholding a prosecutor strike. In the same manner, this court shouldn't tolerate superficial similarities to say that jurors are similarly situated when the substance of their answers suggests that they're not. So we believe that the similarly situated juror factor favors the state. We believe that the reasonable relation to the case favors the state. As to the issue about, well, we found the prosecutor engaged in racial discrimination once, should we automatically indict him for racial discrimination? I believe that in looking what the trial court did, if there was ever going to be a point where the trial court was going to be on heightened security or heightened observance of that, it would be in this circumstance. And I see I'm out of time. May I finish this thought? Thank you. It would be in this situation. But the fact that the trial court did not find that this was a racially motivated strike, but instead that the prosecutor had been racially neutral, I think gives us more assurance that that the court did find the prosecutor credible on this reason. If there are no further questions.
I wanted to talk about two things. The first is, you know, the state sort of conceded that the reason for Brindle or for Thompson's strike was not particularly articulate, not particularly accurate. That begs the question, though, why did the state, was at that fourth strike, you know, not be allowed to strike one African-American juror and immediately hop to the next one without a clear reason in his mind? And it turned out, of course, that this
reason... Well, what about his suggestion that the prosecuting attorney was surprised that the court did not accept the first one? Having tried cases, sometimes you have to go past your first list.
Yeah, I think he was surprised, and I think he had to pick another strike quickly, but it's telling, I think, that he immediately hopped to the next African-American juror on the list and then didn't really have a good reason formed in his mind, and he actually just throughout a reason that ended up not being true. The other thing I did want to talk about quickly, neither of us have talked about this particular issue yet, amazingly. There is an alternative remedy that this court has when there are sort of structural errors with the third step of a Batson analysis. Basically, where the court remands back to the trial court for an evidentiary hearing. And this is typically done where the trial court actually just skips the third step, doesn't make a pretext finding. But it's something that this court, I wanted to make this court aware that that is out there. It's something the Supreme Court considered doing in Louisiana versus Snyder. Because it is similar to this case where the trial court just said, denied and didn't make fact findings.
Well, most of those cases, I think in the original Miller L case, the U.S. Supreme Court did that. But in most of those cases that are around that vintage, it was where they were initially heard before Batson, right?
There are some, and there are actually
Are there some posts like where the hearing is?
There's an Eastern District case from 1999, State versus Nathan, 992 Southwest 2nd 908 is the last one I could find, where, like I said, this is where there's sort of a structural defect with the way the Batson challenge was done. In Louisiana versus Snyder, they ended up remanding for a new trial instead of that other remedy because there had just been so much time between the trial and the appeal. And they just really thought that sending it back would not be fruitful because no one would remember. In this case, it has been 3 years since the trial. And so based on our argument today, we would ask the court to remand for a new trial. Thank you very much.
Case is taken under submission.